Hello, and thank you for tuning in to our debate on United States versus Comstock. My name is Erin Chaley, Deputy Director of the Federalist Society's Faculty Division, and I will serve as moderator. Comstock was argued before the Supreme Court on January 12th and decided on May 17th, 2010. The case concerns the constitutionality of the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act, passed in 2006, which gives the federal government authority under 18 U.S.C. Section 4248 to seek civil commitment of sexually dangerous persons already held in its custody. Under this authority, the government may seek to have prisoners who are either completing federal sentences or incompetent to stand trial remain in federal custody indefinitely. In Comstock, the respondents were prisoners who were completing federal prison sentences when the government initiated civil commitment proceedings against them. The respondents moved to dismiss, in part, on the ground that in enacting the statute, Congress exceeded its powers under the Necessary and Proper Clause. The district court granted dismissal, and the Fourth Circuit affirmed on the legislative power ground. In a 7-2 decision written by Justice Breyer, the court held that the Necessary and Proper Clause does in fact grant Congress authority sufficient to enact Section 4248. Justice Thomas dissented, joined in part by Justice Scalia. Justice Kennedy and Justice Alito, writing separately, concurred in the judgment only. To discuss this case, we are joined by Professor Stephen McAllister of the University of Kansas School of Law and Mr. Ilya Shapiro, Senior Fellow in Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute and Editor-in-Chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. Professor McAllister will make the opening remarks.
Thank you. This is Steve McAllister, and I will just talk briefly about what the opinions said in this case. The court obviously upheld the constitutionality of this federal statute, 18 U.S.C. Section 4248, and the majority opinion notably includes five justices, among them not only Justice Breyer, who wrote the opinion of the court, and Justices Stevens, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor, but also the Chief Justice, who joined the opinion in full. As was mentioned, Justices Kennedy and Alito concurred in the judgment, although in many respects they analyzed the case along lines that the majority did. They just weren't willing to go as far, particularly in the Necessary and Proper Clause analysis. So to describe briefly what the court did, Justice Breyer for the majority basically said there are five factors that cause us to uphold this particular statute. One is a very broad, and I don't think anyone can argue otherwise, a very broad reading of the Necessary and Proper Clause and the deference that the court will accord Congress when the challenge is that it exceeds their power there. Two is a long history of federal involvement in civil commitment of those in federal custody going back to at least the mid-19th century. Three were various what the court described as sound reasons for the statute's enactment because it is dealing with dangerous individuals in the federal government's custody. Four, the court found no intrusion on the state's prerogatives and traditional territory, no 10th Amendment problem, and in fact noted that the statute accommodates state interests by allowing states to take these individuals if states want to. And lastly, the narrow scope, in part by that the court means that only those actually in federal custody are subject to this law, and that by definition is a significant limit. Now, Justices Kennedy and Alito did not like the breadth of the majority's discussion of the Necessary and Proper Clause, although even then they did agree, certainly Justice Kennedy expressly, with the majority's understanding that the inquiry was not just you can go one link beyond an enumerated power and that's as far as Necessary and Proper will take you. Justice Kennedy said, for example, the analysis depends not on the number of links in the congressional power chain, but on the strength of the chain. He was concerned that the majority's analysis might lead too far, but not in this case. I think he and Justice Alito both found in this case the government, the federal government, had a strong interest and a substantial connection to these individuals and in doing something with them at the end of their sentence if they remained sexually dangerous and were not going to be taken by a state, potentially for a state civil commitment scheme. Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia dissented with some strong language about the role of the states and the role of the federal government, significant criticism of the Necessary and Proper Clause, analysis, and also Justice Thomas saying basically even if the states don't want these individuals, it's not the state's choice to abdicate or give up their responsibility for these people. And he would have made the choice, either the states take them or they do go free. But I would say, as someone who represented the states as an amicus supporting the United States here, I think the states are by and large pleased with the end result. The states did not feel this particular statute intruded on their territory or prerogatives. That's not to say the states won't be concerned by potentially sweeping necessary and proper clause analysis if it were to be applied in other settings, perhaps in the future. But they're, I think, not uncomfortable with the outcome in this case.
Thank you very much. Mr. Shapiro, would you like to respond?
Sure. Well, I guess after that thorough description of the opinion, I'll play the role of Thomas and Scalia in dissenting from the holding as Professor McAllister described it. And I'll actually start with a line from Kennedy's concurring opinion. What I liked about Kennedy's opinion is that he lists the various ways in which congressional power is still limited. So I'll look forward to seeing him striking down federal abuses in the future using those. One particular line that I liked was residual power, sometimes referred to, perhaps imperfectly, as the police power, belongs to the states and the states alone. That's really what this case is about. There is no general police power or plenary power that the federal government has to legislate or govern generally for the general welfare or to do what is generally necessary and proper as Congress might deem it fit. Certainly, Justice Breyer's opinion goes very far in that direction, and that's why it's so disconcerting. It transforms what should be an instrumental power, the necessary and proper clause, into an independent grant of authority. And as Justice Thomas says in dissent, the Constitution does not vest in Congress the authority to protect society from every bad act that might befall it. And so, to the extent that the states don't want to deal with these individuals when they've come to the end of their federal terms, that's a judgment call that each state will have to make for the benefit of its own citizenry, or at least should, had the opinion gone the way that I think it should have. Justice Thomas notes that the scheme that Justice Breyer puts into place in expanding the necessary and proper clause it's hard to make work. His five-factor test, of course, Justice Breyer is famous for multi-factor balancing tests, but here we have a five-factor test supporting the conclusion that necessary and proper, that Section 4248 is a necessary and proper adjunct to a whole host of unspecified authorities. But it raises questions of how many of these five factors have to be answered in the affirmative or satisfied to qualify an exertion of federal power under the necessary and proper clause, which three or four, say, are imperative if it's only a majority of them. And indeed, it's a shift from the two-step framework under McCulloch versus Maryland, the old Supreme Court case. And it's not clear why McCulloch's framework is no longer good, why we need these five factors. And moreover, even considering McCulloch's, even if we were to judge this case under McCulloch's framework, which is first, you have to see whether the end is legitimate, that is, whether it's tied to an enumerated power in the Constitution, and then see whether the means to reach that end is necessary and proper if there's a good fit. As Thomas says, quote, unless the end itself is legitimate, the fit between means and end is irrelevant. In other words, no matter how necessary or proper an act of Congress may be to its objective, Congress lacks authority to legislate if the objective is anything other than carrying into execution one or more of the federal government's enumerated powers. He's quoting from time to time there from the actual Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18. And I think we really, there's a great exposition of why holding somebody past the time that they're already in being prosecuted in federal court, held in federal prison. Why going beyond that is simply you have to find a new power to do that. Otherwise, you have to revert to a police power that, of course, the federal government lacks. And this, you go back to the district court, I think, wrote a very interesting opinion about this. In addressing the government's argument that 4248 is justified by Congress's power to prevent criminal conduct, which is ultimately what Breyer is basing this on, the judge, Judge Britt, observed that the federal government simply does not have broad power generally to criminalize sexually dangerous conduct in child molestation. He stated that congressional enactment of the federal criminal laws is itself an exercise of power under the Necessary and Proper Clause, and the power to criminalize certain circumscribed sexually violent behavior is not an enumerated power upon which to premise the civil commitment of any potentially sexually dangerous person as a necessary and proper act. And so the civil commitment has to be necessary and proper to some other thing. And it's unclear how it is connected, not in terms of how many links there are in that chain, as Justice Kennedy correctly wrote, but how that strength of the link to having to or being able to civilly commit someone who has not committed any further federal crime or otherwise, I don't know, endangered federal interstate commerce or the delivery of mail or some other enumerated power, since holding that person doesn't prevent some other federally enumerated power. I don't know how Justice Breyer gets his idea that this is necessary and proper. And it's certainly disconcerting and strange that the Chief Justice joined the majority opinion in whole without writing separately as Kennedy and Alito did.
Thanks very much. Professor McAllister, would you like to respond?
Just a couple comments. I think Mr. Shapiro is hitting on what really is at the crux of the case and one of the difficulties for the court, all of them in many respects, or at least seven of them, wrestling with the fact that Article 1, Section 8 gives Congress virtually no authority over federal crimes, period. I mean, there are a couple things, basically defining and punishing piracies and felonies on the high seas, offenses against the law of nations. I think there's at least one other punishing the counterfeiting of securities in current coin of the U.S., but virtually none of the criminal justice system is based on express powers. I mean, everything's at least a step removed, so even a lot of these statutes are dependent on commerce power, but which itself doesn't say anything about passing criminal laws or creating a criminal justice system. And so really what I think at the end of the day, what the court was confronted with is the entire criminal justice system and of the federal government is built to a great extent on exercise of power basically through the Necessary and Proper Clause. And so the question was, is civil commitment of a certain small, dangerous, specific class of inmates already in the system an improper or somehow unconstitutional expansion of what is already a huge framework built under the Necessary and Proper Clause? And if it is an unconstitutional expansion, then what would that suggest about all sorts of other aspects potentially of the criminal justice system? And that's why I think even Justice Kennedy and Justice Alito says the line cannot simply be one link, or there are going to be all sorts of things that are now questionable that are connected and part of the federal criminal justice system. So, and that's one comment. The other thing would be about the Chief Justice. I think the states would view the Chief Justice as a general matter is not a particularly good friend of the states or of federalism. It's certainly often not been the case in preemption cases, although occasionally he has. And I don't know if that's a result of his experience in the Solicitor General's office, that he has a more robust view of federal power and less concerns about federalism interests than perhaps like Justices Thomas and Scalia. So that's the second point, is trying to think about why the Chief Justice ends up where he did. And the third point would be, you know, a suggestion I've already seen, that does this case portend an outcome in a constitutional challenge to the health care law? And there, I'm not so sure. I mean, certainly Justice Breyer's majority opinion, expansive view of necessary and proper I suspect, will be argued strongly by the federal government in defending that statute. But it's always interesting to me whether that will necessarily translate from a case like this involving the criminal justice system of the federal government, inmates already in the federal government's custody, whether what they say here will necessarily be translated by the same justices in the same way to a very different setting, but for a very, very important federal statutory enactment.
Thanks very much. Since we've moved there naturally, I will ask Mr. Shapiro what he thinks the outcome in this case will have to do with the health care challenges.
Well, I'm also not sure, and I certainly don't take issue with the idea of there being a federal criminal code. Enacting federal criminal laws are certainly necessary and proper to executing some of those enumerated powers. But as the Fourth Circuit said, just because the federal government has tried and convicted certain people, they've now fully served their prison sentences, so no federal prosecution is being frustrated. And just as Justice Thomas said, even though the historical record supports the authority over detaining mentally ill persons against whom it has authority to enforce criminal law, that doesn't give justification for the detention of persons without a basis for further federal criminal jurisdiction. To talk about then the health care challenges, the challenges to Obamacare, is to even take that a step further, and we're really getting into the Commerce Clause. That's ultimately what I think those cases will come down under. And even here, it's problematic to argue that sexual abuse of minors, as horrific that is, where the link to federal jurisdiction under the Commerce Clause or otherwise might be. So to the extent that the court has allowed assertions of expansive government power, regulatory or otherwise, under the Commerce Clause or otherwise, it also necessarily then expands the Necessary and Proper Clause. So we just have a one-way ratchet, and to the extent that that is the case, that does lend credence to those proponents of Obamacare.
To return briefly to an idea that you both touched on, what do we make, looking at the breakdown between the various opinions in this case, what do we make of the fact that there is no agreement on any kind of rationale between any two members of what reporters like to call the conservative bloc on the court, and what significance will that have in this area of the law moving forward?
Mr. Shapiro, you want to comment on that first? Or?
I was just going to say that I think they're struggling with it because, on the one hand, as Alito points out, 4248 is a fairly narrowly drawn law, only applies to the civil commitment of those people being held already by the Federal Bureau of Prisons, who are then certified before a judge to be sexually dangerous in certain ways. So it's fairly narrow as far as statutes, federal statutes can go, and he's basically saying, well, here it's close enough to the general regulation of federal prisoners that it passes muster, but in future cases, I think he's signaling that he might not be as inclined to join, and certainly not under an unwieldy, I would say, rubric that Breyer has proposed. Kennedy as well. I mean, Kennedy in general kind of comes up with his own jurisprudence, and so it's the jury is out on how in a more conventionally divided case with his, being the deciding vote, what kind of framework he would devise. As for the chief, I'm not sure. I really don't know. That surprised me. It surprised, it wouldn't have surprised me for the reasons that Professor McAllister said that he would join the majority, but it did surprise me that he wouldn't explain separately, what his theory was, or maybe even join with Kennedy or Alito on theirs.
Yeah, I would largely echo those comments that the chief's, the fact that he did not join either concurrence, which it would have been easy to do, would have sort of narrowed his agreement, was still led to exactly the same outcome in this case, and perhaps would have arguably given him more room to disavow this case in a future situation. I do find that curious and interesting that he didn't avail himself of those opportunities. I mean, a good example would be the case decided the same same day, the Florida case with the juveniles and the life sentences without parole, he joined the majority, but in the sense of concurring separately to say, look, I'm only saying in this case I think a life sentence is an Eighth Amendment violation. I'm not going to join your overall analysis. And the fact that he didn't do that here may signal potentially something significant. I don't think that actually Justices Kennedy and Alito are necessarily that far from Justices Scalia and Thomas in this case. I think the kinds of things they're talking about to some extent echo and mirror what Thomas and Scalia were talking about. They just, I think, were convinced perhaps by the fact the federal government already has these individuals in its custody lawfully through the federal criminal justice system. It's not that big a leap to go ahead and say then you can also have civil commitment as another aspect of that system, in essence.
I agree with that, but more broadly, I'm just very concerned that this is one more in a long step, rarely interrupted, of the court ratifying larger and larger grabs of authority by the federal government. And to that extent, I think this has ramifications beyond even just the necessary and proper clause.
Great. Well, at this point, I would just ask if either of you have final closing comments that you would like to make before we sign off.
Not for me. I think I've said what I intended to say.
And I think that last one was mine.
Great. Well, thank you both so much for participating and to our audience for tuning in. And this will conclude our discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.